You're listening to Medscape's In Discussion series on Irritable Bowel Syndrome, a podcast where thought leaders and clinical experts share their diverse insights and practical ideas for optimizing patient care. This series is hosted by Dr. Lynn Chang. Dr. Chang is the co-director of the G. Oppenheimer Center for Neurobiology of Stress and Resilience and vice chief of the Vache and Tamara Manoukian Division of Digestive Diseases at UCLA. Relevant disclosures can be found with the episode show notes on Medscape.com or the Medscape app. The topics and discussions are planned, produced, and reviewed independently of advertisers. This podcast is intended only for U.S. healthcare professionals.
Hello, I'm Dr. Lynn Chang, and welcome to Medscape's In Discussion series on IBS. Today, we'll be discussing the role of diet and food with our guest, Dr. Bill Che. Dr. Che is the H. Marvin Pollard Professor of Gastroenterology, Chief of the Division of GI and Hepatology, and Professor of Medicine and Professor of Nutrition Sciences at Michigan Medicine. He is a member of the Board of Trustees at the American College of Gastroenterology and on the Board of Directors of the Rome Foundation. Dr. Che is an expert in the diagnosis and treatment of IBS and other disorders of gut-brain interaction. More recently, he has spearheaded much of the research in dietary factors and modification in IBS. Welcome to In Discussion. So Bill, it's so great to have you. This is the first time I'm interviewing you. So this is a real treat for me, especially on this topic, which is really of great interest to many people. But I want to just start off our discussion with you telling us about yourself and how you became interested in IBS.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on, Lynn. It's wonderful to be on the interviewee side as opposed to interviewer side for once. So I'm from Rochester, New York. I grew up most of my formative years in Rochester. Actually, my father was an academic gastroenterologist. He was chief of GI at the University of Rochester back in the 1980s. I went to college at the University of Pennsylvania and then went to medical school at Emory in Atlanta and did my residency at Emory as well before I did my GI fellowship at University of Michigan. And I mention all this because, interestingly, when I was at Emory, and particularly working a lot of my time at Grady Hospital, the big city hospital in Atlanta, I'm not sure whether to say that I'm ashamed to admit or embarrassed to admit that I never heard the diagnosis of IBS during my residency. It was just not the diagnosis that we gave to the patient population that we served. On the other hand, I got to Michigan, and almost immediately, people were throwing around this term, irritable bowel syndrome, which I had no familiarity with or experience with at all. But the thing that struck me about IBS as I started to get more familiar with it at Michigan was how diverse the clinical phenotype was. It was hard for me to understand how it could all patients with diarrhea, constipation, they're all the same diagnosis. And also how few evidence-based diagnostic strategies and treatments there were. And that's really what got me interested in this space.
Yeah, it's really interesting how there can be very little training about IBS. And you did go to one of the centers of excellence in Michigan for that. So it's really great for people to hear more about IBS. And I think people are really learning and getting more knowledgeable about it. But I want to start with the whole topic of food, because that really is your expertise and your passion. So food can be the cause of IBS symptoms, but it can also be the trigger of symptoms. So how do you envision the relationship of food to IBS as a cause and as a trigger of symptoms, recognizing this can be different between individuals?
Food is the most important trigger for IBS symptoms. Every survey that's looked at this has shown that. And you know, I go back to a little bit of history in terms of how I got interested in food. When I started at U of M, even though, as you say, it was really considered to be one of the meccas for IBS back in the early 1990s when I started here, I kept hearing from patients over and over again, what can I do with my diet to try to address my symptoms, given the fact that it's food that triggers my symptoms? The response that I consistently got from the attendings I worked with was, oh, it's all psychological. It's got nothing to do with food. There is no diet that's valuable or useful for treating patients with IBS. That really piqued my interest because that's not what the patients were saying at all. And it turns out that food is really important in this whole experience. And the surveys would suggest that probably upwards of 80%, 70 to 80% of IBS patients associate their symptoms with food. And I always use the term food's complicated. There's a lot of reasons why food may be responsible for the development of symptoms. We all tend to focus on carbohydrates, but you know, proteins and lipids are probably equally important in individual patients.
Yeah, I think it's so important to listen to patients. And a lot of what I do in my career and my research is really based on what we see in patients. And I think you're doing the same thing, which is really important. Can you explain the difference between food allergy and food intolerance? Because this can be confusing to people with respect to their role in IBS. So if you could also comment on, are there any commercially available tests you would recommend to patients with IBS symptoms?
It's a complicated question, and it's an important question, because patients will oftentimes think that if they have experienced an adverse reaction with eating a food, that it represents a food allergy. And of course, we all know that that isn't the case. Food allergy is an immunologically mediated reaction, typically to proteins within food. And the classic food allergy is mediated through an IgE-related pathway. What we're coming to learn through a variety of interesting experimental techniques, we can certainly talk about that if you want, are that there are probably a number of different types of food allergy variants that are not mediated through IgE. Those are the variants that are the subject of a lot of investigative interest at the current time, whether you're talking about with endoscopic techniques like confocal laser endomicroscopy or with serological techniques like, for example, IgG measurement or leukocyte activation testing measurement. There are a variety of different mediator release testing, basophil activation testing. But you can notice they're all sort of centered on this idea that food leads to this abnormal immunological response, which you could argue may represent an atypical variant of food allergy. Right now, we're really at the beginning of this road. I'd love to be able to tell you a test that I think is really evidence-based and validated and reliable. I'm not sure that that test exists at the current time. There are some tantalizing bits of information for like LAT, leukocyte activation testing, for IgG-based elimination diet testing. Stay tuned. We clearly need to do larger, methodologically rigorous studies to get an idea about whether these things work or not. But right now, there's a lot more promise than there is evidence.
I've seen a fair amount of IBS patients who have said they've had a food allergy testing. And they said, but I don't think I'm allergic to those foods that I'm positive. Do you find that?
Yeah, because a lot of the food allergy testing is actually IgG-based testing. And, you know, right now, there is no validated or clearly most effective, best in practice methodology in terms of how to create or validate those tests. In fact, you know, it's funny, there's a lot of IgG-based tests that are out on the market right now, but they're created in different ways and they focus on different foods. So the bottom line is that all of these tests, although they may have a similar label like IgG-based elimination testing, they're not created equally. And we really need to apply scientific rigor so that we can decide on what not only intuitively makes sense, but what works in clinical practice.
Right, that's so important. What diets have proven efficacy in IBS? And I know you've studied this a lot. And can you explain the mechanisms by which these diets can cause symptoms or also improve symptoms in IBS?
Yeah, that's a whole lecture. But, you know, I'll just try to, in a couple sentences, because there's some interesting new insights into some of the pathophysiology that listeners may be unaware of. So first thing, no question that the most evidence-based diet therapy for IBS at the current time is the low FODMAP diet. And FODMAP, of course, is an acronym that stands for fermentable oligo, dimonosaccharides, and polyols, which are short-chain sugars that the body has a difficult, the intestine specifically, has a difficult time breaking down and absorbing. And for that reason, that those sugars are available for fermentation in the colon, largely. Now, that fermentation has been largely thought to drive why FODMAPs cause symptoms in patients with IBS, because fermentation leads to the production of gas and short chain fatty acids, which can lead to luminal distension, create an osmotic load, which you would expect may trigger symptoms in a patient with underlying abnormalities in motility and visceral sensation. And that makes sense. But there's recent work from the University of Michigan group that actually suggests that a high FODMAP diet, which a lot of Americans are taking, by the way, a high FODMAP diet actually leads to dysbiosis dominated by gram-negative bacteria. Those gram-negative bacteria preferentially produce larger amounts of lipopolysaccharide, or LPS. LPS can lead to changes in permeability of the gut epithelium, which allows it to cross and interact with the immune system and the enteric nervous system. And you can imagine that LPS activating the immune system and the enteric nervous system could lead to changes in motility and visceral sensation that would otherwise look like IBS. So it may be more complicated than just the fermentation and osmotic load story. In fact, I'm quite convinced at this point that it is more complicated than that. But bottom line, there are other diets that are starting to be recognized as potentially beneficial as well, whether you're talking about just common sense recommendations like the NICE guidelines. We're starting to study the Mediterranean diet, actually, which is quite different than the low FODMAP diet. And we'll see whether this shakes out in our studies to be beneficial or not.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier that IBS patient population is a heterogeneous population of different symptoms, and the way patients will respond to certain foods will be different amongst individuals. That's why it's probably hard to have one test for food intolerance. And also the same thing with diet. I mean, really, you get at the end of the day, you're really trying to get a more of a personalized diet, which is what you've always talked about. If you look at FODMAP diet or probably even Mediterranean diet, I think it's going to be important. It's going to differ between individuals, don't you think?
No question. And that's why I say that I always feel like the low FODMAP diet unceremoniously kicked the door open for diet therapies in IBS. So you think about it, before the low FODMAP diet and even during that whole low FODMAP diet introduction, pretty much nobody believed that it was real or that it would work. I can't even begin to tell you how much criticism I got first started talking about this on the national stage in the United States. But I think at this point, everybody believes it. In fact, Lynn, you and I talk about this all the time. I think the low FODMAP diet is overused at this point, not underused. What worries me in particular is the lack of attention in terms of understanding whether a patient has disordered eating or an eating disorder. This is a really important take home for listeners, is that IBS patients very understandably have developed almost a PTSD kind of relationship with food. They eat food, they get symptoms, they don't understand why, they don't necessarily even understand what is causing problems. So they start eliminating things from their diet. And, you know, studies from our group, as well as the King's College group, as well as the Monash University group, have shown that the habitual diets of IBS patients are really a mess. They contain numerous potential deficiencies and are potentially dangerous over the long haul for patients. Not to mention the fact that this cycle of thinking that the solution is always by restricting more and more foods can become potentially dangerous. And think about this, the last thing you want to do as a doctor is recommend a highly restrictive diet to a patient that's already over-restricting their diet. That's why I say at this point, I think we're actually overusing the low FODMAP diet, not underusing it. And I think that in many situations where people are using it, they're not using it properly. They're putting patients on restriction and leaving them on it. They're not providing adequate education or counseling in regards to how to do the three phases of the low FODMAP diet: restriction, reintroduction, personalization. So we have a lot of room to grow and improve, even though diet therapy is really on everybody's radar screen at this point.
I think you're bringing up a really good point. There's two thoughts I had from this discussion. Is one, you know, IBS, the symptoms can be unpredictable and they can be fluctuating. So sometimes food bothers a patient at one day or time, and another time they can tolerate fine. But it gets confusing for patients because the symptoms are unpredictable. They just remove it anyways from their diet. So they restrict more and more rather than trying, and this is probably hard to do, is to find the consistent food triggers and avoid those or minimize that rather than just trying to remove so many different foods. I mean, do you find that as an issue?
Absolutely. And it's one of the things that's potentially attractive about the FODMAP theory is that it may not be the individual food. It may be more the cumulative load associated with the total FODMAPs that you eat in the course of the day. That's one thing that I think actually makes some sense and provides a potential explanation for why there's this inconsistency from day to day. But the other thing that we just talked about collectively is this is why that whole integrated approach with a behavioral health, taking into consideration behavioral interventions as well as diet interventions, is so important, because a lot of times patients are just completely unaware of all these things that we talked about. And if you just point out to them the way that they're over-restricting or even that they're over-restricting, that can be a huge benefit in and of itself. A lot of patients just don't realize that the sort of vicious cycle that they've gotten into.
It becomes like a new normal. You know, well, you did mention that people who have a restricted eating pattern or some disordered eating, which may just be protective to them, but could you tell our listeners who we should not be advocating a low FODMAP diet to, in addition to what you just said? Is there other factors?
It's obvious, and I think most people are able to recognize patients with anorexia. Obviously, you do not want to put a patient with anorexia on a highly restricted diet. Bulimia is a little bit trickier to pick up, but I think everybody's aware of bulimia. The one that I think people are less familiar with is avoidant restrictive food intake disorder, or ARFID. And that's particularly prevalent in GI patients. In fact, our studies, as well as studies from the Boston group, suggest that probably upwards of 15% of patients seen in general GI clinics qualify as or have characteristics that are concerning for the possibility of ARFID. And, you know, ARFID is not just being a picky eater. There are lots of people that engage in restrictive activity, just as you alluded to, but that doesn't rise to the level of qualifying for the diagnosis of ARFID. ARFID is really restricting to the point where it's dangerous. You know, so you're developing clear nutritional deficiencies, you're requiring nutritional supplements, you're requiring enteral feeding or TPN. That's ARFID. And those are patients, again, you do not want to prescribe a restrictive diet to those patients. In fact, it's really important to recognize the possibility of ARFID in those types of people and to make sure that you address it in an appropriate way. Refer that patient to a professional, healthcare professional that has experience in eating disorders and disordered eating.
Yeah, that's really important. Would you use a low FODMAP diet in the different biohabit subtypes? I know that there is evidence that it can help the diarrhea predominant, the mixed biohabits, and even constipation, although it's studied less than the constipation subgroup. But what are your thoughts about the biohabit subgroup?
Yeah, so I think we presented some of the first large-scale data on this actually at the American College meeting this past fall. There have been a few studies that have included all comers in terms of IBS subgroups, but the studies that have been published to date have been like in 10 patients, 15 patients. By the way, those small studies have suggested that there's benefit for the overall symptoms in patients with IBS-C, but the evidence base has been so poor that people have not had confidence that there's benefit. We presented a purely observational, so not a randomized controlled trial, but an observational study where individuals utilized a preset meal plan, low FODMAP meal plan, and it looked at clinical outcomes in individuals of all subtypes of IBS, so IBS with diarrhea, IBS with constipation, IBS with a mixed bowel pattern. And bottom line is that the benefits for overall symptoms, for abdominal pain and bloating, were very similar. In fact, not statistically significantly different for the three subgroups. So it, for the first time, suggested in a real-world study, a large real-world study, hundreds of patients, that low FODMAP offers benefits not just to IBS-D, but also to IBS-C and to IBS-M.
Yeah, that's really good to know. I mean, that's important pearl in clinical practice. Now, I want to talk more about your personalized approach to seeing patients in clinic. How do you approach using dietary interventions in your patients with IBS?
The first thing I try to understand is the patient's relationship with food. Again, that gives you some insight into whether the patient views food as an enemy and is over-restricting. I think that's something that I actually do coming right out of the gate. The other thing that I try to understand is what specifically they've done, you know, like what foods they've excluded, what diets they've tried, because increasingly now in 2023, a lot of the patients that come to see me, they've already tried the low FODMAP diet. I think in that circumstance, it's important to understand, was that with the help of a dietitian? What kind of education did you receive? Did you go through all three of the phases or just like tried it for a week and stopped? And you know, what you'll find is that a lot of the patients that have quote unquote tried the low FODMAP diet really haven't tried the low FODMAP diet. It's perfectly reasonable to try that again with, in my case, we're very lucky to have the assistance of really well-trained expert GI dietitians. I've been playing around a lot with other diet strategies. So we have, as you know, a lot of studies looking at things like sucrase isomaltase deficiency, IgG-based testing. We're also starting a study right now on Mediterranean diet compared to the low FODMAP diet. So we have probably four or five diet studies going on at any given time that patients that are interested can enroll in.
When you're talking about assessing the use and how they've practiced a low FODMAP diet, it reminded me a lot about what we should do with also any other treatments. Like someone may say, I've been on that medicine, it didn't work, but maybe what was the dose? How long did you use it? What was the expectation of what symptoms they were going to improve? You know what I mean? So there's a lot of follow-up questions to really assess how any treatment is being utilized by a patient.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. I would remind people about VA co-op study that Stu Speckler published about gastroesophageal reflux disease, where patients that had failed BID PPI were enrolled into a study looking at a bunch of alternative strategies, one of which was talking to the patient, providing them with scripted instructions on how to take their PPI. And that led to around 15% of the patients getting better just with talking to them about how to appropriately take PPI.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It always comes down to communication, you know?
That's right. That's right.
Okay, so you work with GI dietitians in your practice, and you mentioned that previously, but there are clinicians, patients who don't have access to GI dietitians. What resources or what information can we provide them?
I mean, the good news is there's lots of information. The bad news is there's lots of information. There's definitely a lot of stuff you can find on the internet. I would really stick to credible sources, and some of them like the Monash University website has a lot of information about diet therapies and specifically the low FODMAP diet. There's also another group called the GI Institute, which is a consortium of international GI dietitians that are putting together educational materials as well. That's a good source. Kate Scarlotta and Patsy Katsos have excellent websites that have lots of free information for patients. And now there are lots of books. I've written forewords for probably four or five different books on the low FODMAP diet by people like Tamara Duker, Kate Scarlotta, Patsy Katsos, Rachel Pauls. All of them have written excellent books on the low FODMAP diet that can literally hold the patient's hand as they try to execute the diet in their day-to-day lives.
Okay, that's great. That's great information. So I want to end our interview with a question to you. What do you think the key messages about food, diet, and IBS are and that you would like to convey to the audience? And what also do you see for the future?
First thing is food is the single most important trigger for symptoms in patients with IBS. It'd be wonderful to be able to sit here and tell you that there's one unifying mechanism but as to why food causes problems, but there isn't. Food's complicated. I always use that term as I'm talking to patients. Food is complicated. There are many reasons why an individual might have an adverse reaction to eating a food. So, you know, further research to understand those mechanisms will lead to advances in developing diet interventions for patients with IBS. Right now, the most evidence-based diet is the low FODMAP diet. It's really important to remember that there are three phases: restriction, reintroduction, personalization. and that the diet is best and most effectively administered with the help of a GI dietitian. If you don't have a GI dietitian, just make sure that if you're a provider, that you have a suite of resources available for the patient. Please don't just hand them a sheet of paper with a bunch of foods on it and say, have at it. It's much more complicated than that. And you're really doing a patient a disservice if that's the way you're administering the low FODMAP diet. There are other diets on the horizon. I think a really good way to think about this is the low FODMAP diet was our entry into the diet space, but we're at the beginning, not the end. There's going to be a lot more coming in regards to diet therapies for patients with IBS. And where are we going? I think where we're going is the pursuit of personalized nutrition. Lynn, you alluded to this during the podcast already, because you and I have spoken about this many times, but the bottom line is that I don't think that any diet therapy is going to make everybody better. It's a heterogeneous group of patients. Therefore, the solutions will be heterogeneous. And it'll be important for us to be able to develop biomarkers or diagnostic tests that parse patients on the basis of what is causing their symptoms. So that'll allow us to choose the right diet therapy for the right patient. And there's preliminary evidence from studies to suggest that that approach is at least a possibility. I have a lot of work to actually make that a reality, but preliminary studies really do suggest that there may be signatures in the microbiome, the metabolome, bile acids, that might allow us to choose the right diet therapy for the right patient.
Well, thank you, Bill. Got so much wonderful information, a lot of insights, a lot of practical information. So today we had Dr. Che discussing the relationship of food and IBS, how food could be a trigger, but food is medicine as well. And there's going to be a lot more to come in the future. So thank you so much for joining us. This is Dr. Lynn Chang for In Discussion.
Thanks for listening to Medscape's In Discussion Irritable Bowel Syndrome podcast series with our host, Dr. Lynn Chang. Be sure to look for more In Discussion episodes wherever you get your podcasts. Check out Medscape.com or the Medscape app for show notes, links, and more information on irritable bowel syndrome.